Good morning. First of all, let me say this has been a dream of mine for a long time now, a candidating sermon. You may think I'm joking, but I am not. I remember Laura's candidating sermon 6 years ago and the second hour that followed when she got to talk about all things theological and biblical and liturgical and personal, and I thought, someday. I honestly thought that. Just like when I heard about pastor spouse date nights, I would utter a little sigh of longing. My biggest life dream was to be on the Constituency Leaders Council. That's the group that some have called the crown jewel of the Mennonite Church. It's the group of MCUSA conference moderators and conference ministers, and they meet twice a year to talk face to face. Sometimes they offer counsel and wisdom to the executive board. They always meet around tables. Anyway, weirdly, that dream came true already, so I'm really making progress. I mean, I have other dreams too, of course, like fancy office Christmas parties and children who stay in their beds all night. But I share this with you to say that my dreams have primarily been related to church work. Maybe I lack imagination. I saw what my own mother did and thought, yeah, that looks about right. I literally can't think of anything else I would rather do. Partly, that's true. I saw the joy that church work brought my mother. I liked seeing her up front. I was proud of her. I liked getting an occasional shout-out in a sermon. And I saw that she genuinely enjoyed being with her pastoral colleagues. She genuinely got excited about Advent each year. She genuinely chose the thoughtful dinner prayers that accompanied special meals. I mean, honestly, everything she does it genuinely. But it looked attractive to me. But it wasn't just that, though. The more I explored the Bible and theology, the more I came to it out of my own sense of call and curiosity. I wasn't just copying my mom. I wrote a paper in college entitled, If the Spirit Moves You, Let Me Groove You, A Christian Response to a Culture's Seductive Invitation to Get It On. That was a good paper. And it's not a paper my mom would have written, at least not in that particular way. After graduating from Goshen College, I attended seminary at Iliff School of Theology in Denver, and I felt like a Mennonite fish out of water. But I learned a lot, and I attended other Mennonite congregations in Denver and in Albuquerque, and I learned new Easter traditions, new ways of dedicating babies, new ways of planning worship and of being church together. I have not blindly followed in my mother's footsteps. My shoes are my own. And they are slightly cuter than the Woolruff's shoes my mom wears. Slightly. I am so grateful for what she has given me. Joy in ministry, worship sensibilities, delight in creating new traditions and practicing old ones. And if you had the benefit of having her as your pastor, you know that she is thoughtful and sincere and deeply grounded and creative. I have some of those qualities, and I am not my mother. You are not getting Mary 2.0. You're getting me, and I will screw up sometimes. I am not yet finished with my transformations. And my sincere hope is that here at Assembly, I can grow into the caliber of pastor my mother is, as I live into my own call with my own personality. I want to say also that I am truly humbled to be called to pastor in a congregation with so many courageous, articulate, honest, wise, and loving people. Recently, I was on Assembly's website listening to past sermons, like I do, and I just thought, wow, we receive so many life-affirming and life-giving sermons and stories here. I listened to Kara Shields and Gail Gerber-Kuntz and Susan Lanning and Sandy Fribley and Carmen Horst, and I just kept going. Our sermon archives are a goldmine, my friends. And like I said, I was humbled and a little unnerved. I'm not quite as insecure as Moses. I didn't say to God, I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. I cannot speak to the people. I'm not slow of speech. Some of you have told me I have the opposite problem. I fly through my manuscripts. I have many words to say, and generally I say them very fast. Despite the fact that at the top of every manuscript, I write out the words slowly, slowly, slowly in all capital letters. If I sound slower this morning, it's probably just because Kathy Meyer Rimer is leading worship and I sound slower. Zing. Anyway, as I was saying, I didn't tell God I can't, but I did ask God, am I enough? In a congregation that is so gifted, so rich in wisdom, in theological and biblical knowledge and sermon craft, how can I compete? And I heard God saying, Anna, not everything is a competition. Or maybe that was Brian saying that. Either way, it's true. It's not a preaching competition. Although I did win one of those in college. And I would argue, though, here at Assembly, it's not about being the best preacher or best worship leader or best storyteller. We are not that type of congregation. We come to church expecting to hear something true, something real. And often what we hear is really, really good. But it's not because we have the smartest, most erudite people here. It's because we've created a culture of authenticity, a culture of valuing people's real stories and how those stories are always in conversation with the biblical stories. And it's not about who does that best. There is enough to go around. One person shining their light doesn't diminish everyone else's. Rather, it encourages the creativity of all of us. All of us are encouraged to shine our lights brighter when one person gives themselves authentically and thoughtfully. Nelson Mandela said, "When you let your own light shine, you unconsciously give others permission to do the same." We are a congregation of shining lights. And I have been nurtured and challenged and inspired here by your creativity, your prophetic work, your vulnerability in telling your stories. I want to be a better follower because I come here and I see the way others are making sense of their lives, engaging the text, listening for Christ's persistent call. We all do that together. We need each other, not as competition, but as invitation. Invitation to keep shining in the particular ways we were made to be light to each other. Particularly during the times when the path is not well lit. We put motion sensor lights on our stairs, little round battery-operated ones that are mounted along the wall, so that if the kids get out of bed at nighttime, they can find their way to the bathroom or our bedroom. That works well for Caleb, but Sophie still calls to us to come to her room and wants us to accompany her to the bathroom at night. It doesn't happen often, but I'm always confused when it does. Why am I needed for this? We have a system in place. But as I accompanied Sophie from her bed to the bathroom one night, I realized it does require some amount of bravery and trust to make the dark trek from her bedroom to the bathroom, because you have to move through some spaces of darkness before you set off the motion sensor lights. And they really only give you light until you get to the next one, or even almost before you get to the next one, because before you arrive at the next one, you lose the light behind you. And you have to move into the darkness to set off the light. It is a little scary. The darkness isn't inherently scary. It's the not knowing what comes next. And it got me thinking about faith and the way that it feels like we have to move through some times of darkness before the light appears. It appears when we need it, but it never illuminates the whole path. We can't see the whole way ahead. We keep moving forward and trust that as we do, the next light will appear to guide our steps. And ideally, we have companions who help us be brave, who tell us about light that they've seen, who help us walk in the darkness until the light appears again. I know that Jesus said, "I am the light of the world, and whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." But that hasn't been my experience. There are times when we walk in darkness, even with companions and light bearers. The week of waiting for my father to die was one such time, a time when my path was not well lit. I knew that it would end at some point, that he would be released from this life and the captivity that it held him in. But the waiting felt interminable. I like to make a plan. I like to see the whole picture. I like knowing where I'm headed. I like to be in control. But that week of active waiting in what felt like darkness stretched me. And the light felt skimpy. The manna inadequate. We got through each day, but it felt like God was holding out on us a little. And when I was at my lowest points, I had an image of Depression-era breadlines and ration cards. Like maybe God is keeping manna or light somewhere and divvying it out a little at a time so that we don't run out and everyone gets their fair share. And I know that's acting out of scarcity mode, acting as though light and love and manna are non-renewable resources. And I know from singing the song that there is more love somewhere, which makes me believe that there is more light, more manna, more everything with God. And as Kara reminded us this summer, the love of God isn't held back for later. God is not holding some of God's self back, waiting for the right moment. God is all in. But if God is all in, then why do the Israelites only get manna one day at a time? Why only enough light for five steps of our journey? Exodus 16 tells us that the recently freed Israelites were beginning to grumble in the wilderness. It had been 1 month and 15 days since their journey out of Egypt, and the Israelites had had quite enough of freedom if it meant being hungry. If only we had died by the flesh pots in the land of Egypt when we had our fill of bread, for you have brought us into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. As one commentary put it, the Israelites are inveterate doubters and whiners. I love the complaining Israelites. Sure, we all go crazy when we hear our own kids complaining about being hungry. Stop whining. Stop demanding snacks. You literally just ate. But in the Israelites, I find it honest, refreshing, and endearing. They have complaints about the conditions, and they make them known. I mean, they are in the wilderness. There is no food. So they're hangry. And God listened. God told Moses, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. And each day the people will go out and gather enough for that day. In that way, I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. Spoiler alert, they do not. God rains down bread. Moses imparts the specific instructions to gather only as much as you need and do not save any for tomorrow. But some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, and it began to smell and was filled with maggots. So Moses was angry with them. It feels like a little bit of a setup to me, like God knows they're going to screw this up. Why even bother testing them? I wonder if this is a teachable moment for the Israelite people. It's not just about the food. It's about training the people to rely on God. Moses was angry because the people hoarding the manna were trying to rely on themselves rather than God. They were living in scarcity mode. There may not be enough tomorrow, but if you can stockpile enough manna, you don't need God anymore. You don't have to rely on God's daily goodness. I get why that's attractive. It's nice to be able to control your own food supply. And yet there is also something lovely about being fed, about recognizing that you do not have to do everything yourself, being cared for, being vulnerable, allowing others to feed you and care for you. The week that my dad died and in the weeks after, many of you brought us food, like you do. And the food reminded us of all the people who were walking with us. It reminded us that we did not have to do everything, and in fact, there was very little we could do or control. That was a week of receiving what was being given. And there were many gifts that week, many small paper lanterns lighting the way. And it was still hard. I would still rather be in control, still see the whole picture and turn on all the lights and have a full pantry of food just in case. And yet real life is never quite that simple. We are never fully in control. We never see the whole path ahead of us. And I think God is trying to teach this to the Israelites. Are you in the wilderness? Yes. Am I providing for you daily? Yes. God isn't rationing. God is reminding. God is trying to tell the Israelites, I will be with you. I will provide for you. You do not have to do it all yourselves. And because I know you will forget this, put the manna in a jar and keep it throughout the generations as a reminder of the way I fed you in the wilderness and brought you out of Egypt. We have a God who longs to be in ongoing relationship with us. The manna keeps coming to remind us of God's steadfastness, God's faithfulness. God is not rationing. God is reminding. The manna is not a one-time thing. It keeps coming because it is a reminder that God is continually faithful. It is a visible, edible reminder of God's care. Day after day, we keep being fed. We don't have to do it ourselves. We don't have to stockpile. God will give us what we need. God gives us enough. And if we truly believe that, then it's not a leap to believe that there is enough to go around. We don't have to be or do everything. We are enough. And on this World Communion Sunday, as we eat the bread that Christ offers us, the communion bread is the reminder. It is the manna. It is the light. It is the tangible sign that God is faithful and wants to be in relationship with us. Whenever you do this, remember me. Remember my faithfulness. Remember, I want to be with you. Despite your grumbling and your complaining, despite your slowness of speech or rapidness of speech, despite your patience with whiny children or your petty competitiveness, you are my beloved. I will feed you. I love you. And there will be enough.